Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the indispensable shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor, and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. My normal partner in this enterprise, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at Center for Strategic and International Studies, is traveling in the Middle East. He'll be back in the new year to join us. But I'm joined today by a very special guest and a former colleague in both government and at the U.S. Institute of Peace, Ambassador Bill Taylor, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, former Chargé d'Affaires to Kyiv in a very interesting point of time, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, distinguished military officer, served in two of America's storied military units, the 82nd and 101st Airborne, also with a master's in international public policy from Harvard, and someone who with whom I've had the pleasure of working across 30 years in government. So, Bill, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Eric, it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be here.
So let's start with the state of play on all things Ukraine. We're actually recording this at the exact same time that President Zelensky is meeting with President Biden. So we don't know the outcome of that visit. But what's your sense of the state of play on the Hill? What are the odds we're going to get this supplemental package that's so desperately needed? As you may have seen, Jane Harman and I, the co-chairs of the National Defense Strategy Commission, had an op-ed in The Hill last week calling on behalf of all the bipartisan members of the commission for passage of this legislation. It's a little bit hard to figure out how we get from here to there, even though there still seems to be a majority in both houses in support of this. Where does this stand? And as a former ambassador, how well advised do you think it was for Zelensky to make this appearance here?
So, Eric, on that last question is a good one, and several people have discussed this. I've had conversations about this, and it gets to your earlier part of your question. That is how serious it is, how dire the situation is. The Ukrainians need this support. The Ukrainians know that the United States is the single largest provider of weapons, of ammunition, of intelligence, of the things that they need if they're going to defend themselves against the Russians. With the funds rapidly running out, you spent time in that building. You know how the accounting goes, and all of your old colleagues are telling me the same thing. That is, it's down to fumes. It's down to the bottom. So Zelensky knows this, and the Ukrainians know this. And so it gets to your question about taking the risk of coming here. And it is a risk. It was a risk for him to make this decision. If he can't convince Congress, the American people more broadly, then it will be seen to have failed. Not a good thing. He has the support of virtually all Ukrainians. He has demonstrated a leadership and it being able to inspire the Ukrainians, not just the Ukrainians, inspire the world on this fight. So this is a big risk. And if it goes badly, if he doesn't, if he's not able to convince enough people to pass this, it's a big problem for him. It's a big problem for Ukraine. He knows that. So it's a risk. But on the other hand, he had to do it because it is so dire, because it is so important because it is critical that he get this assistance. He had, I think he probably figured he had no choice. His chief of staff, the head of the presidential administration, Andriy Yermak, was just here last week. Of course, making the same case and talking to similar kinds of people, not quite the level that President Zelensky is this time. But I'm sure Andriy Yermak went back and said, you could do this, boss. You could do this, Mr. President. And I'm sure he thought Zelensky and Yermak and that team thought very carefully about this and figured that they had to do it. Now, that gets to your question about how balled up it is, what the chances are. And I totally agree with you that if this were to get to a vote and have it pass easily 4-1 in the Senate, if even on the House floor, probably, 3-1, a majority, bipartisan majority in both houses would support this. The American people, there have been polls and polls, but the American people, even though it's not the same level of support it was a year ago, they still support by majorities, solid majorities, more support for Ukraine and continuing assistance. But it's gotten wrapped up. This Ukraine assistance has gotten wrapped up with the assistance for Israel, as well as the whole border question, the defense of the border. And to be fair, President Biden did put all of those together in a package. And so he almost invited this this confluence, this confusion, this delay capability by putting Ukraine assistance in with these other controversial pieces, in particular border. And so President Zelensky is here. Now, it's interesting, Eric. I was at a meeting with him with a small number of people last night over at the embassy, Ukrainian embassy, and he was there to kind of ask for advice on how to deal with all this and answer questions. He was very open, and he got two different sets of advice about how to deal with this border question. One set of advice, people said, Mr. President, you know something about borders. You've been defending and moving back toward and trying to emphasize the importance of borders. You could say something about that. But then another thread of advice was, Mr. President, be real careful not to get involved in our U.S. domestic politics, which is interesting. And I had a similar conversation, Eric, with him. And Yermak back in 2019, when he was in danger of getting wrapped up in domestic politics then. So it's the same kind of issue now. My bet is he will be making the case that you and I just talked about, the importance of providing this assistance for Ukraine at this point so that they can succeed on the battlefield. I want to come back to your good question about what that means. But what it clearly means, as far as the United States support goes, it is crucial. And so he's here making that case. And you're right, we'll listen to him and President Biden when they come out of their meeting and make the statement. But this is an important time.
As a former ambassador, not to Ukraine, but to other places, really would not be wise for him for the long run to get in the middle of a very contentious American domestic political debate. I mean, I take the intellectual point about the importance of borders. That's sort of right intellectually. It's just probably not right, politically, for him. Bill, do you share my sense that of two things? One, that we're running out of time to get a deal done. My operating kind of calendar, I mean, obviously there's a legislative calendar. We're running out of legislative days. Senate's supposed to go out on Thursday. I mean, obviously Senator Schumer could keep them in if it looked like there was a deal. But on the other hand, Senator Lankford, who's one of the lead border negotiators on the Senate side, says no deal in sight. The White House is kind of finally beginning to get into this. I see that the chief of staff of the White House, Jeff Zients, is now kind of involved in these negotiations, although not the president, which to me is astonishing. So my operating kind of calendar is, after January 15th, the Iowa caucus, when it becomes apparent that, you know, Donald Trump is going to be the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, the chances of getting Republicans in the House to vote for this start to really fade away. And so that we're operating on a very short timeline. And second, I've been screaming and yelling about this since last August, and I've had a sense that the White House had a not adequate sense of the urgency of getting this done on the Hill, that they thought that putting the border in was a nice sweetener for the Republicans, and that was it. It was all going to happen magically. You know, Kevin McCarthy would make it happen. To me, that was always sort of, you know, delusional. And I know from talking to Senator McConnell's folks that they were waiting for outreach from the White House to, you know, help them with this. And am I missing something, or do you have the same sense?
I have the same sense. I don't think you're missing anything. I am glad to see that the White House is finally getting engaged. And I think you're exactly right. The president needs to himself be engaged. I mean, he makes the case for him that this is what he does well, you know, in particular in the Senate. So you would think that...
And in particular with McConnell.
And in particular with McConnell. And he's had some success in putting together bipartisan deals in the Congress. So and if it is true, and I believe it is, that he does recognize the importance that you and I just described. He recognizes the importance of Ukraine winning. And the importance of Russia losing. I think he does recognize that. And this is his now. I mean, he is all in, you would think. And so being all in, you would think he would do whatever is necessary to break this loose. You're right about time running out. And so, you know, I haven't given up, but it's getting pretty bad. You know, here we are, you know, a couple of days before the Senate might go out. And there are two big things to be worked out. That is the border and the assistance package. So it's dire. Which goes back to the point about Zelensky. I mean, he was actually down at the inauguration in Argentina, and came up here en route back. And this was a risk, as you have said, but a risk that he probably thinks he has to take because time's running out and because it's so important.
Bill, I wanted to turn to an issue that's been thrown out by a number of opponents of, you know, additional assistance to Ukraine. There's one kind of argument that they make, or people who claim they're for it but don't really want to vote for it, who basically say, well, show us the strategy. What's the strategy here? You know, what's the end game? When does this end? You know, and then there's a second argument, which is, oh, you guys all told us that they were going to have this big counteroffensive and succeed. It failed. So why throw, you know, good money after bad? Some of those arguments are made in totally bad faith. So I don't even want you to necessarily address those. But it is an important question, I think, why the counteroffensive did not meet expectations a lot of us certainly hoped for, if not expected. And we now hear a lot of discussion of, you know, new strategy. I mean, I, you know, spent a couple of days in the Pentagon last week, and I heard a lot of what I would describe as, you know, ass covering, ex post facto rationalizations for why this failed, most of which were along the lines of, Ukrainians didn't fight this the way we told them to. They didn't mass their forces in one place and break through to Melitopol on the coast and split the Russian forces. They frittered their forces away on Bakhmut and Avdiivka and getting a lodgment across the Dnipro and Kherson. They just didn't do what we told them. And they didn't use the equipment we gave them. They didn't use all the armor we sent, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which I found borderline. I mean, I could imagine as a Ukrainian how I would have felt had I heard that. I mean, you know, we expected them to, you know, mass, you know, against this Russian defense in depth, which turned out to be, frankly, I think a lot denser and more dug in than even we thought, without air cover and superiority. the armor we gave them, our M1 Abrams tanks, didn't show up till late, you know, September, when this fight was going on in June, July, and August. So I frankly did not find this, you know, very persuasive. But it clearly there's a, you know, a bit of finger pointing going on both sides. Can unpack all that for us?
Thank you, Eric. No, it's interesting what you heard in, from American sources and others. So since the big full-fledged invasion, I've been to Kyiv five times. The sixth time will be next month. The last trip, which is in October, I had the opportunity to sit down with General Zaluzhny. I'd met him one time before, many months ago. So in the first maybe four or five months of the full-fledged invasion. But this time it was the two of us having this conversation, and part of the discussion, Eric, was on this topic. And again, this is in October. About the same time, by the way, that he must have been talking to The Economist and writing that essay for The Economist. But he said a couple of interesting things, in particular, looking back on it, kind of thinking about what he said. One thing, and your friends in the Pentagon and my old friends in the military will be interested in it. He said, armor is obsolete. He said, armor is obsolete. He said, both sides now, both the Ukrainians and the Russians, can see so well into the battle space, deep into the battle space, that they can see where the massing is taking place, and they can see where the thrusts are going to come. And not only can they see them, they can target the armor very, very precisely with a lot of different things. He was talking about drones, but it's also precision artillery and other precision weapons that. And that led him to say, he said, he was explicit. He said, armor is obsolete. Another thing he said, this was about the time that the Russians had thrown a lot of their armor into Kupiansk and had lost incredible amounts, like Avdiivka, where they continued to lose just incredible amounts over and over. And like the Ukrainians did in June, in the first part of the counteroffensive. They lost just a lot of armor, both because the other side could see and they could target. So that led him to the conclusion, which does get to this question about the tactics. You know, yeah, we trained them and we equipped them for combined arms and mass, concentrate, breakthrough, exploit, shatter the morale of the enemy. But it turns out that that's real hard to do in this new circumstance, the new circumstance of drones, of visibility in both directions, and so. General Zaluzhny said a couple of interesting things beyond armor is obsolete. He said that he has fought this war, and he said, you know, NATO hasn't fought a war like this. And he said, we've learned a lot, and one of the things is big armored thrust is not the way to win this war. He also said that he's quite a scholar. I was impressed. He's quite a military scholar. I mean, a couple of times he was in his office in an office. He moves around, of course, but in an office that was pretty well established. Right behind him were a big library, big bookshelf full of military history books and tactics and strategy. And a couple of times he reached back and pulled one out and read from it. In particular, we were talking about stalemate. We were talking about deadlock. He said, you know, this reminds me of something I read in Russian and in Soviet military history about World War I. So all to say, he'd given a lot of thought to this. He's a thoughtful man. He said, you know, the Chinese, when they invented gunpowder, many... centuries ago. That changed warfare, he said. And he said, technology is the new gunpowder. He said, whoever exploits, takes advantage of, advances, figures out how to use new technology and breakthrough, they're going to have an advantage on the battlefield. And then he was, of course, talking about drones, but a lot about electronic warfare and counter drones that don't get the same kind of focus as HIMARS or ATACMS or Abrams tanks. But they're really he sees this technology as being a major shift in warfare. And he says the timeline, the turnaround, the feedback loop between the front line, his headquarters, and the manufacturers of drones in little towns and houses around the country is quick. That feedback loop is very quick and efficient. And he says, we do this, we are flexible enough to do this. And I don't think, he said, that NATO and the United States are in the same category, that you can do it as fast as we are. We are fighting a war that no one has fought before. So that gets to this next question, Eric, that you asked about this possible change in strategy or tactic. I'm not sure which it is here, but it is if it is true, if Zaluzhin is right, that that armor, big armor thrusts and breakthroughs are not going to happen for the reasons that we've talked about, then what's the alternative? How to win this war, which they're still focused on? And the long-range fires provided to them with the capabilities of the long-range ATACMS and the unitary warheads that allows them to go after, maybe not destroy the Kerch Bridge, but they can do some real damage to, they can disrupt. And if they can do the same kind of thing on the land bridge. So in other words, if they could use long-range fires to go after headquarters, supply dumps, lines of communication, bridges, to damage the ability, to reduce the ability of the Russians to sustain their troops in Crimea, or sustain their troops in Zaporizhia, or across from Kherson. If they can do that kind of damage, that's different from trying to break through, well-defended lines. It's more of a, and then you can use infantry, which they've been using. You can use infantry to go across, not in the same way tanks did, and certainly not as fast as tanks do. But you can do other tactics to be able to, in the end, you're going to have to occupy territory. I mean, he understands that. But it's not going to be, in his view, through tanks and armor and infantry fighting vehicles and armored personnel carriers. It's going to be destroying Russian sustainment and rear areas and headquarters, and then a slower but probably more effective, well, he hopes more effective infantry tactics. I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I mean, again, you spent time over there in that building thinking about these things.
Well, a couple of things. One is, to your point about the training we gave them. Well, number one, yes, we trained them to do combined arms operation, but we trained very small numbers over a very short period of time. As you know yourself, when we do this, we train units, round the clock for the whole year before they go out, to California, to the National Training Center, where, blue plays, red, and red always beats them because this is hard. So it's hard for our guys training year round with all the stuff we have. And we expected the, Ukrainians to master this in 6 weeks. To me, that was always a little bit unrealistic. On the theme of, the changing character of war and the technological elements that you and Zaluzhny talked about, that's, of course, the theme in a lot of ways of his lengthy essay that he appended to his interview with The Economist. And I thought there was a lot that rang true as I read that. I'm not sure armor is finished. I mean, I think it's a little premature to write the obituary of the tank, which has, you know, been written, you know, many times. But certainly I'm sensitive to the point he makes about electronic warfare and long-range precision fires being used together with drones, you know, all together to disable the enemy and allow you, you know, to attack. As we speak, the Israelis are using Merkava tanks and are in dire need of shells in Khan Yunis. So, you know, I don't think the tank is done just yet.
But I don't see Hamas firing back with tanks.
No, that's true. But I'm just saying there's a place for tanks.
Is a place for tanks.
They're not.
The battlefield that Zaluzhny is looking at, you know, he's fighting the bloody Russians.
No, I get it. Who've lost a lot of tanks themselves.
Yep.
And certainly the long range fires, the Ukrainians have used them to the ones that we've given them to great effect, whether it's the HIMARS, the Excalibur rounds, the British Storm Shadow or the French Scalp E, or the shorter range attackums with the cluster munitions warheads that we've given them. They've used to great effect against the Russian helicopters, which were part of that kill chain you were describing earlier. They ran into in the early parts of the counteroffensive. It was those Ka-52 helicopters coming up with standoff missiles that were taking out a lot of the Ukrainian APCs and tanks in that initial go round, as I understand it. So they were able to, you know, knock a lot of those out on the ground with the cluster variant. By the way, I still don't understand, even though I've had people in the Pentagon at pretty senior levels explain to me why we can't give them all of those cluster version of the ATACM, because we got about 1,000 of them, I think, and we won't use them because they violate our cluster policy. Now, there's an argument that was made to me that, well, but if we run out of all of our unitary warhead ones in extremis, we would have to use those. I mean, my view of the lesson of this war, or one of the lessons of this war, is this kind of combat, and I think we would find that in a China contingency as well, consume enormous volumes of munitions. And whether it's loitering munitions or 155 shells or tank rounds, as the Israelis are discovering, is just a lot of munitions. And one of the things that, with the favors that Vladimir Putin has done for us, is expose the frailty of our defense industrial base and its ability to mobilize and produce large numbers of these things if, God forbid, we get into a shooting match with one of these adversaries around the world. So the answer shouldn't be, well, we only have enough to, you know, to meet the demands of our existing, you know, O plans. You know, the answer should be, we got to produce more. So, you know, let's provide the Ukrainians with these things, because they're actually fighting one of our O plans right now for us. So why don't we, you know, do that to reduce one of our adversaries while we start cranking up the machinery back here to produce more of these things, so we could be the arsenal democracy. So that's my take on it.
Absolutely. Totally agree. And that's, you know, as you say, kind of a silver lining. They've highlighted the need for defense industrial base modernization and expansion, again, re-expansion, to do exactly this. No, I think that's right.
You know, on the whole question of Zaluzhny's economist interview and his memo, you know, I mean, I find that, as, you know, someone who spends some time studying the, you know, future of warfare, very, very interesting. However, I'm not sure if, as a sitting defense minister in the middle of a war, I would have actually published that in The Economist, or, you know, given it to The Economist to publish, you know, without giving my president a heads up, apparently, as I understand it. I mean, what do you make of that entire episode, and what does it tell us about the political dynamic inside Ukraine?
That's the right question. So my sense of him is a dedicated, focused, professional military officer with no political ambitions that I could detect, or that, you know, that I've seen from others. that's not to say there aren't people who think that he has political ambitions, or there's not to say that there aren't people that suspect that if he were to develop political ambitions, he'd be a formidable adversary to whoever he goes up against. And so that has led to the kinds of things that people have written about, which is this apparent tension between Zelensky and Zelensky, the general and the president. They both know the importance of unity, and they both know how dangerous it is, or would be, for there to be daylight between the president and the general. But it gets to your question, Eric, the internal politics of Ukraine. You know, the Ukraine is a real raucous democracy. And it's, you know, it has been arguing and debating and, you know, scrapping about policies having to do with East and West, Europe and Russia, NATO or not, language issues. I mean, this is a real democracy that has had harsh, even debates about these kinds of things. So they're real. But since the 24th of February, 2022, even the opposition leaders have fallen in behind Zelensky and have supported, you know, whether or not he's accepted their support in some real sense. There has not been the sniping that you got. So I was there, Eric. I was in Kyiv one of the times just before the invasion. So I was there in January of 2022. At the end of January, probably 3 weeks before the actual invasion.
Yeah, I remember you were there with a couple of other of your former ambassador colleagues.
And a couple of we had an interesting time there because we had to divide up our delegation. Half had to go to a public event, and two of us, General Hodges, Ben Hodges, and I, got to go talk to President Zelensky. But we also, in that same trip, we talked to opposition leaders. Yulia Tymoshenko, for example, and Petro Poroshenko, clear opposition leaders and clearly opposition. And just before the invasion, so 3 weeks before, they were doing what opposition leaders do, and that is pointing out the problems and pointing out the mistakes that President Zelensky was making. But as soon as the invasion, they all fell in and offered their support. And that continues. I firmly believe that that Zelensky has no political ambitions at this point, and so can contribute to this unity. That said, there are some, you know, so 18 months. You know, I was there at the beginning, but also I've been there, you know, last October, for example, and talked to people. And sure, I mean, 18, 19, coming on 20 months of fighting. And of horrible conditions, not just for the soldiers, horrible for the soldiers, but really bad for the people, for the Ukrainians. I mean, the attacks on the electrical infrastructure means that it's cold and dark and sometimes hungry and without water because the electricity runs the water pumps. It's miserable. And so you get these tensions. And these tensions are gonna spill out, and people were saying, well, you know, we should have been better prepared, or you know, what about this, counteroffensive, and you know, there are these kind of little rumblings, but the people and the military and even the politicians, even no matter what they say, kind of privately or quietly, they are strongly supportive of the president, strongly opposed to negotiations, for example. Strongly opposed to compromises with the Russians to stop it. Very concerned when they hear Americans. Nobody in the U.S. government that I've heard yet, but there are Americans out there who are saying to the U.S. government and to others, you know, it's time for negotiations. You know, the Americans should push on their Ukrainians. Well, the Ukrainians are not buying it. Virtually none of the Ukrainians are willing to even entertain that. So all to say that the politics are showing the strain. What's going on there is after 21 months of fighting and of miserable conditions, they're tired. They are tired. They're not giving up. They will, and go back to our earlier conversation, if we get tired and if we stop supplying them with the weapons they need, they'll continue to fight. They will fight on with whatever they have. Europeans are stepping up to some degree, and good for them. Good for them. The Europeans kind of worry that we might be falling off, and Europeans worry about other political changes that might happen, and they're stepping up. And they need to step up a lot.
They do. And the only problem I have with that is that their defense industrial base is even worse shape than ours.
Correct.
And therefore, their ability to actually fill the gap, you know, absent a U.S. sizable contribution is somewhat limited. Bill, you know, another argument you hear, another criticism you hear of Ukraine and of President Zelensky is that he's becoming an autocrat. You know, they're supposed to have an election, and he has said, well, you know, according to the Constitution in Ukraine, you can't have an election when there's, you know, martial law in effect, which, or a state of emergency, which they have, and therefore he's governing as an autocrat. I mean, you've addressed some of that, you know, already, but it does seem to me that they're, you know, it is an issue to that people are not wrong to be concerned about, right? I mean, it, in other words, it's very easy to slide into, you know, from military necessity to, you know, I am the law. And so how should the U.S. government and European governments think about that and deal with it? And then the second one is, you know, to try and do all the things all of us who support Ukraine against Russia, you know, want to do for Ukraine, whether it's EU membership, whether it's NATO membership. Obviously, Ukraine has to clean up a lot of the flaws that it's have. I mean, you've rightly pointed out the fact that this has been for a while a pretty lively, vibrant democracy, but a very flawed one with very significant, in particular, corruption. To his credit, I think Zelensky has taken steps against some of the Ukrainian oligarchs. Some of that's been facilitated by the fact that a bunch of them were kind of in Putin's pocket, so it made it easier to go after them after February 24th. But it's also opened him up to these charges that he's acting, you know, kind of in a high-handed, autocratic way. What can we do to take advantage of the moment that this offers us to clean up, you know, some of these corruption and other issues that have plagued Ukraine?
Absolutely, Eric. No, you're exactly right. So two things: elections, and then the reforms and corruption. On elections, this was prompted. You're exactly right. I mean, it's against the law. It's against the Constitution for them to have elections when there's a martial law. They would have to change that, and you can't change the Constitution while you're at war. So while you're in martial law, so they would have to violate the Constitution to have elections. And the election idea came from some Westerners, actually. A U.S. senator showed up and came out of a meeting with President Zelensky and said, I think there should be an election this year. And so that kind of, and then there was a European official who made the same suggestion or request, or, you know, asked the same issue about, you know, about election. And the society, as well as the opposition, as well as the government, has debated that. It was a serious question. And in the end, after a couple of months of this, again, prompted by some questions from foreigners, concluded exactly what you said. A couple of things. One is, it's against the law, against the Constitution, it's martial law. Two, the Brits didn't have, they say the Americans, you know, Americans had elections during World War II, and we said, yeah, but we weren't fighting on American soil. And which gets to the point about soldiers. Soldiers, A, would like to vote, and B, soldiers probably like to run. I mean, we talked about Zelensky. I don't think he has any interest in it, but there are going to be soldiers when the elections come who will be popular, and Zelensky recognizes that and says, this is why we can't have elections now, because we can't pull soldiers out to come vote or run campaign because the Russians will take advantage of them not being there. And the concern about, you know, probably 7-8 million Ukrainians who are abroad, mostly women, but it would have to vote in overwhelming numbers in Poland and the Czech Republic and in Germany and in Portugal, some here, but it's not set up. There's no way to do that.
The mechanics would just be very challenging.
It would be incredibly challenging and expensive. People have suggested online voting, and you know that is not going to happen in wartime. All to say that that the opposition and even the you know the pro-democracy non-governmental organizations, the activists, said they signed a big letter saying not now. After the war, the Ukrainians continue to say after the victory. After the war, after the victory, then yes, of course you have elections, and that's what Zelensky has also said. On the Eric, your question, good question on reform and corruption. The EU did an amazing thing. June of 2022, they said, you're a candidate. Ukraine, you and Moldova are candidates to join the EU. And that has incentivized, that has really kicked into high gear a lot of reforms, a lot of issues that are going to be hard for the Ukrainians to do politically to bring their systems into alignment with EU standards. But that is a heavy reform incentive that is going on there. And on corruption, you're exactly right. They have done some things. They've got big problems. The two biggest sources of corruption that my experience, both times I was there, were one, oligarchs, which you talked about, and two, courts. And they're related because oligarchs could buy judges, but the courts were notoriously corrupt. In fact, is one of the maybe the worst court, the most corrupt court, was some little court called the Kyiv District Administrative Court, KDAC, Kyiv District Administrative Court. You say, administrative court in one little district, what's the deal? How can it be? Well, it turns out that being in Kyiv, where the government is, if the government took a decision that you didn't like, you could go to the Kyiv District Administrative Court and get it overturned or blocked or somehow. And the Chief Justice of the Kyiv District Administrative Court was almost certainly pro-Russian. I mean, he was pro-Russian and almost certainly taking money from the Kremlin. And so he was a big problem. So so when I was there in 2019, I said to Yermak's predecessor, Bogdan, I said, you know, it turns out the USAID lawyers have found a way. You can get rid of that court under your constitution. You can get rid of that court. And Bogdan at the time said, yeah, we'll take a look at it, but it didn't do anything. But last year, so a year ago now, in the middle of this war, Zelensky eliminated that court. I mean, he just wiped it out, number one. Number two, the perception of corruption is measured every year by Transparency International. There are some 200 countries on that. Ukraine used to be in like 166. The Russians were always lower. The Russians were more corrupt, always perceived. But nonetheless, that was not a good place to be. And Ukraine's now, I think, at like 116. So they've made a lot of progress. Still not great, 116, you know. But they made big progress beyond the courts that I mentioned about, you know, setting up and establishing the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine. They call it NABU, and the Special Anti-Corruption Prosecutor's Office, SAPO. High Anti-Corruption Court was designed to try, it's a special court to try senior officials who are accused of corruption. And what Zelensky has done is given them the capability to do their jobs, which they didn't have before. And they have, and they're now restated this, the most intrusive public disclosure, financial disclosure for public officials of anywhere in the world, certainly anywhere in Europe, it's more than ours. You have to list every, you know, watch or car or flat in Dubai or, you know, apartment in Kherson, or for you and your wife. And the kicker here is they put it online so that the very, very aggressive press corps can go in there and say, oh, you know, this mayor in this town, we know how much money he makes. And we know it, because of this disclosure online, we know he owns some flats in London. what's going on here? How can you? It's all to say, Eric, that they have done a lot on this and they should be given credit. They've got more to do. There's absolutely no doubt about that. They know it, the people know it. The government knows it and they're taking steps. But I think this is one that they are addressing. EU membership is a big thing, but also they know it's important for them.
Bill, we're running short on time and you're in high demand because of the events of the day. So I want to wrap this up. I do want to, you just started to say, I don't think you ever completed the thought that Britain did not have elections during World War II until after VE Day, at which point then Prime Minister Winston Churchill was unceremoniously turned out of office after having won the war by the British people and replaced by Clement Attlee in the middle of an international conference at Potsdam. So
I imagine President Zelensky knows that history. Nonetheless, he's committed to having elections afterwards, after the victory.
So I really wanted to close on what I think is the big question sort of facing members of Congress as kind of they look at themselves in the mirror in the morning, whether they get this done, whether they do their jobs and get this done or not, which is what happens if we don't get this? What are the likely consequences, you know, in Ukraine? I mean, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, has said there is no plan B. You know, we run out of money. Now, of course, they run out of money to replenish U.S. stocks, but there's still a lot of stuff that was procured by the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative funds that were put on contract that haven't been delivered yet. So there will be some continuing delivery of some items for, you know, period of the next year. That's not enough to sustain the Ukrainians, but it's something, it's not nothing. And there is this lend-lease authority that the Congress gave the administration before the big packages got approved. So what's your sense of the consequences and what's the plan B?
So the plan Bs are not well established, and you've just gone over a couple of them. When I asked about lend-lease earlier, before it looked like we were going to run out of money, the answer from your old colleagues in the Pentagon was, you know, why would we use lend-lease when we're providing this drawdown authority? Lend-lease, they're going to have to pay it back. But now it turns out that I imagine they're taking a look at that. You know, there is that authority there. There are questions about the levels of stocks. And I would say that one of the, it's not a plan B, but another minor issue, they can look to see if they've been, how conservative they've been on drawdown of stocks. Now, you will know more than I about these operation plans in other parts of the world that demand, that require stocks of
war reserve stocks. Yeah,
war reserve stocks. And we're pretty conservative about that. And, you know, normally we should be. This is the war. This is the time. And if you said we're starting to crank up our ability to replace those, so that we that. The you know, we may not have a plan B. The Ukrainians are thinking about this, as I say. They are they're talking with the Europeans. Europeans are working on their plan B. But frankly, the sad thing is what Zelensky said last time when he was here, and I imagine we may hear it again, is if this is not passed, they will have a real hard time winning this war. They will have a very hard time. And then, Eric, you and I will be asking questions, you know, I hate to use the kind of, you know, if Ukraine is lost, if Russia wins and Ukraine loses, we're going to be asking ourselves, why was that? And the consequences of that, of Russia being on the border, it's already on the border, of course, of Finland and Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. But on the border with Poland and Romania, and to see what the Russians will do if they win this war, which, you know, their odds go up if we don't provide these weapons. And the same thing in the other parts of the world. You know, the other things that, you know, if President Xi sees that the Americans are not there for the Ukrainians and give up on the Ukrainians, get tired, or can't meet their commitments, he's emboldened. There's no doubt about it. So there are dire consequences here, which again goes back to what we started to talk about at the beginning. This is why Zelensky's here, just to be able to make that case.
Hard to disagree with any of that. Our guest has been Ambassador Bill Taylor. Bill, thank you for all of your service to the nation and your continued service at USIP. And I know how active you've been in terms of this Ukraine fight and always on the side of the angels. So thank you, and hope we can have you back from time to time on Shield of the Republic to take the temperature on where we are in Ukraine. Hopefully not to debate who lost Ukraine.
Eric, it's an honor, a pleasure to be here. I love talking with you about these kinds of things, and I'd love to do it again.
Thanks, Bill.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.